The opinions expressed here today are strictly those of the individual OA member and do not represent OA as a whole.
Welcome, everybody, to the sponsorship training webinar. Woo! An unprecedented event. My name is Diane T, and I am a compulsive overeater. Westchester United Intergroup, the virtual region, all welcome you in joining us for this exciting and, again, unprecedented sponsorship training webinar with Harlan G. He continues to motivate, inspire, and help thousands of those with our affliction. Harlan prefers to keep his program simple by solely using the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he believes in quickly and efficiently taking sponsees through the 12 steps within 2 weeks maximum. So, interpreters and guests, as we extend the heart and hand of the OA Fellowship to those who still suffer, Harlan G. will now share for 1 hour on how he quickly and efficiently takes sponsees through the step. Harlan, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Diane. Thank you very much. I'm so honored to be here. My God, this is quite a group. Good Lord, there's 280 people here this morning. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. The first thing I want to talk about is, what is sponsorship? What is sponsorship? We're here for a sponsorship workshop. What is it? You'll notice that the word sponsor does not appear in the first 164 pages of the big book. Doesn't appear. The word sponsorship changed in its meaning from the time that AA was first starting in 1935, and then it changed in 1939 after the book was published. And I'm going to go through that quickly. I am very into history. I know that we're going to get into the specifics of how to sponsor each thing, but this, I believe, is important. I hope you enjoy it, and I hope that the information will help you. The word sponsor was first used in 1935 through the spring of 1939, because the stigma of alcoholism in the 1930s was dramatically different than the way we interpret alcoholism today. If you were an alcoholic, admittedly so, by coming to the meetings and identifying yourself as an alcoholic, you could be ruined financially. You could lose your job. Your wife could divorce you. Your husband could divorce you based on that, by that admission. If there was a social stigma to the word alcoholic, that was beyond what we know today. The stigma was horrible. So the word sponsor from 1935 up until the spring, April of 1939, meant that when you came into a Oxford group meeting or later on an AA meeting, the sponsor was the person who vouched for you because they didn't know you. If they didn't know you and they didn't know you were a very, you know, alcoholically drinking person, they didn't know what your agenda was. So a sponsor would speak up and say, here's Fred. I drank with Fred. I believe him to be an alcoholic. I believe that he is here for legitimate reasons. And that is what sponsor meant. Now, the book was published on April the 10th, 1939. April 10th, 1939, the book is now in the world, and the father of modern-day sponsorship, as we know it today, was Clarence Snyder. Clarence Snyder is the father of modern-day sponsorship, using the book to bring about the knowledge that was imparted to him to the person that they are sponsoring. And this is where it comes from, sponsoring. So this passage of knowledge of how I work the steps to the people that I sponsor is the essence of the definition of sponsorship. What you're essentially doing is you're taking the hand of your sponsee and you're joining it in the hand of God as best you can. What are some of the things people fear about sponsorship? What are some of the things why people hesitate to sponsor? They're afraid they're not going to do it perfectly. They're afraid that they are not going to get the results that they want. They're afraid that the person won't like them, won't think highly of them. And what we're going to be talking about today is the metamorphosis, if you will, of a person who was very, very into what you think of me, am I going to do it right, to a person that knows I'm doing it correctly because I've had a spiritual awakening as a result of the book and the steps in the book. And I believe that if you follow that path, you too will recover and have a spiritual awakening. Clarence Snyder broke a chain. And what chain did he break? When AA was first getting started, both in Akron and in New York, there were some differences. But when AA was first getting started, people would rush and they would follow this person. This person seemed to have a good sobriety. Well, then that person would have an issue. So they would go follow this person. And then they would go follow that person. And so it was boom, ba, boom, ba, boom, ba, boom. The book codified the recovery. The book made it so that the message of the recovery could not be garbled and changed. And what Clarence Snyder did was he took the book and he changed many of the statements into questions. For example, let's take a look at any chapter you want, okay? Let's take a look at any chapter you want. I turn to page 43. I turn to page 43, just randomly. It says here, Fred's story speaks for itself. So he would change that into a question and say, does Fred's story speak for itself to you? The next sentence is, we hope it strikes home to thousands like him. Clarence would change that to, does this story strike home for you? If you want what we have and you're willing to go to any lengths to get it on page 58, then you're ready to take certain steps. Do you want what we have? He would change it into a question. And then he would ask you, what is it we have? What we have are people. Not just that we're not compulsively overeating. I hope that's true for all of you. What we have are people here that are compulsive overeaters who are not eating compulsively, and they are happy in their release. And in order to achieve that, one must have a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. And in order to have a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps, we pass the knowledge of how that's achieved through the book from one person to another. Now, I'm going to quote Clancy Immersland. Clancy is one of my heroes in this program. I've met him twice. He's passed away. But Clancy Immersland said this. When one alcoholic talks to a second alcoholic, so that the second alcoholic starts to identify with the first alcoholic and begins to take action after action after action that he does not yet believe in, this is the point where recovery can take place. So let's get into some specifics. And the first chapter that we're going to talk about is not the beginning of the book, not the forewords, not the prefaces, nor is it the symbol of AA. I don't sponsor like that. I go back to that later. That's fine. I want to get you through the steps as quickly as possible. Now, in keeping with this, I want to get you through as quickly as possible. I'd like to point out some things because I hear a lot of people sponsoring and I hear a lot of people being sponsored in a very protracted, copious, long, elongated system. And they take forever. I've heard of people taking a step a month. I've heard of people taking long, long times to sponsor. This is killing people. You have to come to this point as quickly as you can. It's on page 89. Nothing ensures immunity from drinking like intensive work with other alcoholics. That is the promise of promises. It says nothing ensures immunity from drinking like intensive work with other alcoholics. Wow. I want that promise. I want immunity. When Bill Wilson takes the steps, and Bill Wilson takes them on page 13, he does them very, very quickly. After 2 days at Towns Hospital, free of liquor, he takes the steps on page 13, and by the time the next day dawns, he is already doing step 12. He wasn't done with his ninth step amends, but he did all of the steps in one day. Now let's take a look at something else, which is very, very important for us to see, because without this, it is very, very hard to understand the vital nature of quick movement through the steps. Let's take a look at page 184. This is in the story that's called Alcoholics Anonymous Number 3. And I want to point out to you the second paragraph from the top of the page, the one that begins with during the first 6 months of 1935, I was hospitalized 8 times for intoxication. This is, of course, Bill Dotson. Now, I want to point something out to you because it's important. It says here, I'm shackled to the bed 2 or 3 days before I even knew where I was. So he was sober for a couple of days. On June 26, 1935, I came to the hospital, and to say I was discouraged is to put it mildly. Now, why is that important? Let's take a look at who's calling on Bill Dotson. Who's calling on Bill Dotson? Bill Wilson, with his 5 months, 6 months of sobriety, and Dr. Bob, who had 16 days of sobriety. Now, I want to focus on Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob got sober, as we know it, on June the 10th, 1935. But I'm going to let you guys in on a secret. He really got sober on June the 17th. But Bill and Bob were not good when it came to certain dates. They just weren't good with dates. But the medical convention that Bob attended didn't end on the 10th. It started on the 10th. Bob didn't get back to Akron until the 17th. But let's go with the original date of June 10th, because that's in the book, so let's not change anything. 16 days after Dr. Bob got sober, he is calling on Bill Dotson. I would be willing to bet that there are not many of you that were making 12-step calls, sponsor calls, 16 days after you got sober. They went through the process quickly and efficiently. Now let's take a look here at page 214. 214. This is the story of Fitzmayo, and the title of the story, I'm in the fourth edition. The title of the story is Our Southern Friend. And this is, of course, the story of Fitzmayo, and the person that comes to call on Fitzmayo at Towns Hospital is a man by the name of Silas Bent. Silas Bent was the one who visited Fitz in the hospital, and Fitz will become very instrumental in the early formation of Alcoholics Anonymous. He and Bill Wilson were very good friends. Now, on page 214, in the second or third paragraph down, it is the line, I went out of here 9 days ago. I hope you're all looking at where it says, I went out of here. Where's here? Here is Towns Hospital, okay? I went out of here 9 days ago saying that I was going to be honest, but I wasn't, he answered. Now, let's take a look here. He says, where am I going with this? Troubles are over. The man leaves the room. Wait a minute. I kind of lost down on here. Here it is. That's good. I don't know where I was going with that one, but Silas, he went out of there 9 days ago. Right. It was right in front of my face. He left the hospital 9 days ago, and he's already calling on Fitz Mayo. 9 days had he left. I'm sorry I lost my consciousness there. I'm going to be 70 years old, so, you know, I get frabrutaled a little bit, too. 9 days ago, he was in a hospital, and he is sponsoring. Very important. Okay, now go to page 226. 226. 226, and on page 226, we are seeing the story of Jimmy Burwell called The Vicious Cycle. The Vicious Cycle is about AA's first atheist, and it's Jimmy Burwell, and I'm concentrating on the paragraph, this was the background that made me willing to listen on January the 8th, okay? I'm in that first full paragraph on 226. This was the background that made me willing to listen on January 8th. After being dry 2 weeks and sticking close to Jackie, all of a sudden I found I had become the sponsor of my sponsor because Jackie went out and drank. So he was the sponsor of his sponsor within 2 weeks. And the sponsor, let's keep reading, for he was suddenly taken drunk. I was startled to learn he had only been off the booze a month or so himself when he brought the message to me. How many of you are sponsoring 9 or 2 weeks after you get sober, after you get abstinent? Very few. This is a quick process. Okay, now I'm going to get into some more meat and potatoes specifics on what I do. Now, I cheat when it comes to sponsorship. I do. I'm unabashedly a cheating cheater. I use my podcasts to sponsor. I want them reading the chapter. I use my podcast as a commentary.com because it's more detailed. If you want to read the chapter with them, that's not wrong. That's perfect. That's the way it was done for generations, is to read the chapter with them. That's fine. But here is the doctor's opinion. Here's what I do. I have them listen to the chapter, or you can read it with them, but there's a certain amount of information I need them to glean out of the doctor's opinion. I don't need them to be an expert on the doctor's opinion. I do want them to know that Dr. Silkworth was highly, highly instrumental in the formation of AA. I want them to understand. This is the specifics of what I want. I want them to understand that without Dr. Silkworth, there's no book and there's no program because we don't know what the problem is. We just don't know what the problem is. And without a knowledge of the problem, nothing would make any sense. It just wouldn't make any sense. So we have a situation where I want them to know that about Dr. Silkworth, and I don't necessarily want them to be an expert on his life. I just want them to know how important he was and that he didn't want his name in there for the first 10 printings of the book because his opinion was unfounded scientifically. And I want them to understand that this man, Dr. William Duncan Silkworth, the little doctor who loved drunks, he stuck his neck out so that we could live. He stuck his neck out and said, I'll write this for you. Just don't put my name in there because none of his theories were founded. And then because of a paper by Harry Thibault, in 1950, the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association, accepted alcoholism as an illness, and he said for the 11th printing, you can put my name in there now. And Dr. Silkworth died in 1951. But he remains to this day, and will forever remain, our great medical benefactor. Without him, there is no book. Without him, there is no program. What did Dr. Silkworth teach the world? That this is an illness. It is not the result of bad hygiene, bad thinking, stupidity, weak will. It is none of the laziness, uncaring. It is none of those things. It is an illness of the mind and an illness of the body. That our minds are honing in an unnatural way on the effect, on the food giving us an effect. And that effect is that sense of ease and comfort that comes instantly by eating that food. And that food is never the problem. Food is the solution to the problem. So the first thing I want them to know, and I will listen to them on the phone when they call me and they're done. Most of the people I sponsor don't live in Arizona, so it's all phone and Zoom. If you're sponsoring someone that lives close to you, all the better, all the easier. Most of the people I sponsor, or all the people I sponsor right now, live in other states. One lives in Sweden, and they all live in different states. So one of the things I want you to understand is what is the nature of this illness? It's a twofold illness. What is the nature of it? This is what I want them to know. It is an allergy of the body. What does that mean? Well, when I eat chocolate, I don't break out in a rash. I don't get itchy, watery eyes from eating chocolate. No. Allergy has several different meanings. One of the meanings of the word allergy fits me exactly. It says in the dictionary, some of you remember dictionaries, it says in the dictionary, an adverse, abnormal reaction to a food, a beverage, or a substance. Adverse means it's harmful, and abnormal means most people do not react the way I do. The reaction from the food is adverse and abnormal. What is this reaction? That it sets me up with an actual physical craving for more of the same. In other words, when I eat for me, I'm not talking about for you. I'm talking about chocolate for me, potato chips, fried foods, bread, anything like that. I am going to want more. The more I eat, the more I want, the more I want, the more I eat, the more I eat, the more I want, and it is just endless. There's no end to it. There's no end to it. So, for me, this allergy manifests, and people like me, I assume you, this allergy will manifest with an actual physical craving for more of the same. Now, I also need them to understand something else. And if they don't understand this, I send them back to listen to the podcast again. And if we need to, I will read it with you. But I only have one day where they have to finish each chapter. One day. One day. So, we have to come to this understanding. The other part of the illness is the mind. It is a twist of the mind. In the 12 and 12, Bill Wilson will call this the mental obsession. But in the big book, which is what I like to stick with, is the big book, he calls it the peculiar mental twist. The words mental obsession are not in the big book. They use the words twist of the mind, peculiar mental twist. And I also want them to understand that the reason that they're focused in on this is because food is never the problem. Food is the solution to the problem. So in the first few pages of the doctor's opinion, we get this information. They must have it. The allergy of the body, that it is a disease, the twist of the mind. If they don't have that, we have to go back and do it again. Now at the bottom of page XXVI, for the first of four times, Dr. Silkworth is going to tell them, you must put down the food. You have to have the food down. There are pockets of OA and certain people who believe you can work the steps to get abstinent. Dr. Silkworth could not be more clear. You have to have the food down to have a spiritual awakening. If you are still eating, the chances of you having a spiritual awakening, in my opinion, and in Dr. Silkworth's opinion, and in Bill Wilson's opinion, and those who I think matter, is you will not. The food must be down. Okay? Very important that they remember that. Now, on page XXVII, the second time at the very bottom of the page, it says, of course, an alcoholic ought to be free from his physical craving for liquor, and this often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological spiritual measures can be of maximum benefit. That's the second time he is telling you, put down the food. Now, this next paragraph on page XXVIII at the bottom of the page must be understood. It must be understood because this paragraph is so paramount to our lives that if the book was a building, this would be the cornerstone. If the program was a building, this paragraph would be the cornerstone. And this paragraph must be understood. But this paragraph, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. This paragraph is paramount. What is this paragraph telling me? This paragraph is telling me that food was never the problem. It is the solution to the problem. And if food is the solution to the problem, then what is the problem? The problem is the buildup of human emotion. Happiness, guilt, shame, fear, anger, remorse. All these emotions in the mind of a compulsive overeater. I deliberately said happiness first. I have eaten railroad cars full of Chips Ahoy cookies when things went well for me. It doesn't mean that any time things go bad, you eat. You eat when things go good. I know I did. So that has to be brought up. Food is the solution to the problem. It is not the problem. And what is this effect? The problem is the absolute discomfort that we have with the emotional state that we were born into a world that we are scared to death of. Before recovery, if you had come up to me and asked me, how you doing, Harlan? If I was honest, and I wasn't, I would have said to you, I'm scared to death. And you might have said, what are you scared of? I would have said, I don't know. But I watched the world pass me by. And I saw people in the world that to my eyes seemed happy and together, and I was not. And I constantly compared my broken, shattered insides with their seemingly together outsides. And I knew I didn't measure up. And food gave me an out. Marshmallows, cookies, potato chips made the world a beautiful, groovy place. The only problem is it only lasted about 9 seconds. About 9 seconds. And then the allergy takes over and I can't stop. And I ate more than I had intended to. So I want them to understand that food is not the solution, food is not the problem. It is the solution to the problem. Okay? Very, very important. Now I want to go to page XXX. It says the only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. One paragraph up from the bottom of the page, the last sentence of it is the only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. What does that mean? It means we do not eat our binge foods and we do not go over the amounts of foods we have been given by our food plan at all. And if we do, we start over. Very important. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. So what is it that we need to take out of the doctor's opinion? It is an illness. This is not something that happened to me because my mom or my dad or you or my girlfriend or my teacher in third grade or whatever. This is not something that has a reasoning within the world we live in. It is because it is. My favorite title of any story in the back of the book is Because I'm an Alcoholic. Why are you a compulsive overeater? It has nothing to do with most of the things you think. It has to do with the fact that you are a compulsive overeater. Nothing of this earth can cause the disease. Nothing of this earth can help you. Your relief must come from a higher power. Bill's story is next. It's divided into two sections. We're going to go through this without going into a ton of specifics. But what we learn in chapter 3 is illustrated beautifully in Bill's story. What is it we learn in chapter 3? Well, I'll give you a preview. We learn that the disease has two characteristics, an allergy of the body and a twist of the mind. But it has three traits. What are those traits? It is permanent. It is progressive. And if untreated, it is fatal. I'm going to say that again. It is permanent. It is progressive. And if untreated, it is fatal. Is it permanent if you're not eating? Yes. I have not compulsively overeaten in 25 plus years. I am as much a compulsive overeater. I'm more of a compulsive overeater now than I was 25 years ago because of the progressive permanent nature of the disease. And in Bill's story, from the very, very first page to page 8, we see Bill's plunge into the abyss of his alcoholism. In every paragraph, life is getting worse and worse and worse and worse for Bill. And the more we see that, the more we understand our own lives. The disease is permanent, progressive, and if untreated, it is fatal. So we have a situation on our hands where what I'm asking these people to notice about Bill's story, what I'm asking them to glean out of here is not just history, because Bill's story is chock full of history. What I'm asking them to notice is the progressive nature of this illness. Very, very, very important. So important. We see Bill on page 1. He's getting out of the service. He fancies himself a leader for not the men of my battery giving me a special token of appreciation. My talent for leadership, I imagine, would place me at the head of vast enterprises, which I would manage with the utmost assurance. By the time we get to page 8, Bill had been in his mind condemning people that killed themselves. And by the end of page eight, he has seriously considered taking his own life. That this is a disease of self-loathing. That this disease doesn't just make me fat. I had a friend of mine in OA, my first sponsor, Della. She said to me, Harlan, if all this disease did was make you fat, wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. It's the self-loathing. It's the self-incrimination. It's the ennui. It's the fear that it produces in me, the anxiety producing disease. I'm afraid to go out. I'm like an agoraphobic because I'm an object of ridicule. Children would laugh at me. The world rejected me in the most sound terms. This world says to me when I'm a fat boy, you, Harlan, are unacceptable. Unacceptable. And we become afraid of people. And we lead a very sheltered and very isolated life. Any abuser will first isolate you and then abuse you. And this disease is a master at abuse. Now we see in the second eight pages of Bill's story, we see how Bill, through Ebbie Thatcher and the Oxford group, is introduced to a spiritual solution to his problem. Now, Ebbie didn't know the problem. Bill did because he learned it from Silkworth. And there's 306 of you here today. It's very important that you say to your sponsees, this is the nature of the problem, the physical allergy and the twist of the mind. But Ebbie didn't know the problem. Bill didn't know the solution. So Ebbie says to Bill, I've got this spiritual solution. And in Bill Wilson, it came together like a confluence. What's a confluence? It's when two rivers come together and merge to form yet another stronger river. They came together. The nexus in the world, the nexus, the joining together of the problem and the solution will come together in Bill Wilson. Is he the first person to have this information? We don't know. But here's what we do know. He will become the first person in Earth's history to synthesize this information, to put it together, and bring it to the world in a book. Okay, so on the bottom of page 14, we've been talking about sponsorship. That's what this is. It's a sponsorship workshop. We're going to hear Ebbie telling Bill something that's going to be very important for our work today. Bottom of 14, page 15, when I sponsor you, you read this paragraph every day for 3 months, 90 days. My friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. What are the principles? The principles are the steps. Okay, so we're going to practice these principles in all my affairs. Does that sound familiar? It's what we know today as step 12, isn't it? Yes, it is. Particularly was it imperative. What does imperative mean? It means important beyond all else. It's important beyond all else. What's important? To work with others as he had worked with me. You don't want a sponsor, you're probably not going to recover. You cannot do this in an 11-step program. I need a 12-step program. I can't recover on an 11-step program. It's got to be 12. Okay. It's imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead. And somebody I totally love told me one time, works without faith is dead. Faith without works is dead. Works without faith is dead as well. He said, and how appallingly true for the alcoholic. This is important that they get. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, in other words, sponsoring other people. Now, all the work that the committee here, the translators, it's being translated into a bunch of languages, and the virtual region put this together, Diane and all these people that put this together, That's great. But if I do that kind of work and I don't sponsor other people, I'm not going to recover. And I don't know about you, I'm here to recover. I'm not here to die in the disease. Okay, Papa 15, it says he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. In other words, no matter how evolved my recovery gets, I will never rise above the level of a human being. And as a human being, I'm going to have good times and bad times and up times and down times. That's part of being human. If he did not work, he would surely drink again. If he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. Very important. Let's move on to the next chapter here, how to sponsor. There is a solution. Now, one of the things that's very important to me may not be so important to others, but you're asking me how I sponsor, so I'm going to tell you. I think that when they go through this chapter, one of the things they need to know is there is a solution, because for thousands of years there wasn't. For thousands of years there was nowhere to go and nothing that could be done. And today God has given the world a solution to addiction. This book has restored more alcoholics, drug addicts, compulsive overeaters, love addicts, sex addicts, gamblers, internet addicts, nicotine addicts, God knows what, back to society than all other methods combined. That there is a solution. And it is so vital that we understand that there is a solution. Now, before I say this next thing, I want to tell you, this is for me. This may not be for you, because at the very beginning of this seminar, we heard the words read, we respect other people's diversity, and you may work the program another way, that's okay. I'm not here to grade your paper, that's all right. I'm talking about me, the guy I see in the mirror. For me, there is a solution. I wasn't great at making decisions. Now I'm much better, much better. One of the things that helped is my recovery, because it made me a person that could make decisions in a much, much more efficient way. But I was bad at making decisions, and I don't want to have to make decisions. So what I did was I made the decision based on, would it make you like me? I don't have to do that today. There is a solution. This book is my solution. My solution. So when they listen to this chapter on the podcast, and we're talking about this chapter, we go right to page 19. I want them to understand the rest of it, yes, that it is an illness, but we've already talked about the fact that it is an illness. But I want them to go to page 19. We feel the elimination. I'm in the second sentence of the first paragraph. We feel that the elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. And this refutiates everything I have been taught from the time I was a child. I've been taught it by my parents, by doctors, by everybody. Lose the weight and everything will be fine. Baloney. Baloney. Losing the weight is a bare beginning. We feel that elimination of our drinking is but a beginning means a much more important demonstration of our principles. What are the principles? The principles are the steps. Lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. What does that mean? I have to work these steps in all of my affairs and my life will get better. The mere losing of weight was accomplished by dieting. It didn't cure me. I was on diet pills at 9. I was on diet pills at 10. I was on diet pills prescribed by a doctor at 14 years of age. It didn't cure me. And the book isn't going to cure me, but the book will give me relief. It'll give me recovery. There's no cure for alcoholism, but there is recovery.
The opinions expressed here today are strictly those of the individual OA member and do not represent OA as a whole.
I want them to understand that on page 20, in the middle of the page, it said, it is the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. In other words, this tells you why the book was written. And there's three places that tell you that. The foreword to the first edition, is important because it says to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered. I'm on page XIII, fourth edition. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. Now on page 20, it says it is the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. And on page 45, it will say the main object of this book is to help you find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. Is that consistent? Yes, it is. I want them to understand that. I want them to understand it is an illness. I want them to understand about the fellowship. But those don't need my specific explanations right now. I'm sticking to what needs my specific attention in this seminar. And on page 23, I want them to tattoo this in their, in the inside of their eyelid and in their brain. Top of the page, first full paragraph, second sentence. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. We treat the body by not ingesting those alcoholic foods that are triggering the allergy. We treat the mind with the steps, with a spiritual awakening. Now remember, again, they are listening to my podcast on the entire chapter. They are exposed to the entire chapter through the reading and my podcast. I want that to be very clear. I'm not saying that the unenumerated parts of this chapter in this today's seminar are unimportant. They are not unimportant. But for the sake of our seminar here, these are the things which must be accomplished. Okay? This is very important. Now, on page 26, I want them to understand that this comes from Dr. Jung through Roland. Jung told Roland. Roland told Ebby. Ebby told Bill. And Bill told the world. I'm going to do that again. These words are not in the book. I'm just summarizing. Dr. Jung in Geneva, Switzerland, told Roland of the spiritual solution. Roland told Ebby. Ebby told Bill, and Bill told the world. Chapter 3. More about alcoholism. I want them to understand that this chapter beautifully, gorgeously illustrates step one, and this is the last of the chapters on step one. What chapters are step one? The doctor's opinion. Bill's story. There is a solution, and more about alcoholism. Those chapters, although there is the history of step two in Bill's story, and there is the history of step two in There Is a Solution, these chapters are mostly concerned with step one. Step one, okay? Very, very important, okay? In More About Alcoholism, we are going to see that I cannot simultaneously control and enjoy my drinking. But let's take a look at some things. On page 30, it says, it says here, no person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Sometimes we want to be different. The ego's tricky. Sometimes we want to be different. Sometimes we want to be the same. Depends on what will destroy us faster, because the ego wants it to destroy us. Okay. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. No, I can't. I cannot simultaneously control and enjoy my drinking. If I'm controlling it, I cannot enjoy it. If I'm enjoying it, I cannot control it. Impossible. I am a compulsive overeater. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession. What is an obsession? It is a thought which pushes aside all thought to the contrary. A thought that pushes aside all thought to the contrary. Okay? This is the great obsession of every abnormal drinking. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it to the gates of insanity or death. I want them to understand that in this thing, what we're going to talk about here is we have to fully concede to our innermost selves, second paragraph, that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. What is the first step? The first step in recovery is this conclusion of the mind, the acceptance of the mind that I am a compulsive overeater. And the depth at which I accept that will mark the urgency that I will work the rest of the steps. If I haven't conceded to my innermost self that I am a compulsive overeater, I truly won't see the need to do the rest of the work. I only will fare forth in high hope and do the rest of the work when I have conceded to my innermost self that I am doomed if I don't. While there's a flicker of hope in my soul, while there is a flicker of hope in my heart that I can beat this on my own by myself by just curbing my appetite, by just avoiding certain foods, I am doomed. I'm doomed. And in this chapter, more about alcoholism, we are going to see that the disease is permanent, progressive, and if untreated, fatal. A man of 30, that story is timeless. A man of 30, he didn't drink for 25 years. Did that make his disease go away? Did it abate his disease? Did it relieve his disease? You bet your bippy that it did not. You bet your bippy that it did not. He was dead within 4 years after he started drinking again. I want them to understand that it's permanent, it's progressive, whether you're drinking or not, and if untreated, it is fatal. I want them to understand about the peculiar mental twist on page 33, the twist of the mind that drives me into the food against my will in search of relief from the intenable, unbearable pain of not eating. I want them to understand that on page 34, or excuse me, not page 34, on page 35, when we talk about Jim, that he drank and he put the whiskey in the milk because he was just deluding himself that that would be okay. This man had been in an asylum. Now, there's a lot of information in Chapter 3 I want them to have. We don't have the time to really go over it now, but these are the things I need to glean for you so you can become more effective sponsors if you choose to sponsor in the way that I do, in the way that I am. I can only teach you what I know, and I can only teach you what I do. I can't teach you any other way. If I thought there was another way of sponsoring, I would go do that. I would go do that. Now, it's very, very important here. This is very, very key that we look at the jaywalker. Now, the jaywalker, although is a classic, it's a total classic, but the jaywalker absolutely illustrates beautifully the permanent, progressive, and if untreated, fatal nature of this disease. In every sentence of the jaywalker, his situation grows worse and worse, never better. And finally, his life lay in ruin. He lost everything. He lost everything. And no matter how intelligent we may have been in other respects where alcohol has been involved, we have been strangely insane. It's strong language, but isn't it true? I'm not a stupid person. I have a reasonable amount of sense, yet I couldn't stop eating on my own. I couldn't do it because it's a disease that is far more powerful than me. And the brain that I have is a sick brain. I cannot use that brain to get out of the disease. Very, very important. Now, at the bottom of page 43, now there's a lot more information in this chapter. I want them to have it, but these are the things that must be gleaned out for them to survive and for me to be happy. But on page 43, this is vital. Once more, the alcoholic is at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. Without a willingness to believe in a higher power, without a belief in a higher power or a willingness to believe in a higher power, I'm doomed. What is an agnostic? Chapter 4. It's without one who has no knowledge. Ag means without, Gnostic means knowledge, one who has no knowledge. They don't really know whether there is a God or there is not a God. They just don't know. I am a believer that there is a God. I am a believer. And for me and many people like me, we still have to apply that belief to our program by action. We have to take action. Very important. We agnostics, and agnostic is someone without knowledge. But I have to ask myself this all the time. Where in my life am I being agnostic today? What areas of my life is my agnosticism causing me great grief? My agnosticism can kill me. It can kill me. But let's go over to page 45. And the thesis line of the big book is on page 45. It's almost midway down the page. It says, well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. Do I have a relationship with the same God today that I had 60 years ago, 5 years ago, 3 years ago? No. Life changes. And it changes and changes and changes. And so my belief in God, my idea about who God is and who God is not, changes too. And what's very important for me to pass to you is that that's okay. Life changes. And so my idea about God or what I'm working on with God will change as well. Very important. Page 47. This is the blood and guts of step two. If they don't understand anything about step two, this is the guts of step two. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? I don't care how atheist you are. I don't care how agnostic you are. Do you believe, or are you willing to believe, that there is a power greater than yourself? If you honestly believe that you are the be-all and the end-all, that you are Mother Nature, Father Time, Father Christmas, Father whatever, if that's what you really believe, there may not be any way I can work with you. You must be at least willing to believe that there is a power greater than yourself. Very important. Let's move to chapter 5, how it works. See, we're going quickly. They get exposed to the bedevilments. They get exposed to everything in chapter 4 through the podcast, but it's not vital right now that they understand that. They have the rest of their lives to to expand their knowledge, to expand their horizons. I'm getting them through the steps quickly. Now, what I want them to understand is, on page 58, if you've decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. What does that mean? What do we have? I mentioned it before. It's not just that we're not compulsive overeating. It's that we're happy in our release. I was miserable when I wasn't eating. When I was chewing on a Tootsie Roll, or I was eating a Milky Way bar, or I was eating M&Ms, the world was my little oyster. At least, you know, for the first 9 seconds, then it became a nightmare. But for the first 9 seconds, the world was my little oyster. And then it wasn't. But if I want relief from the intenable pain of not eating, I have to work these steps. And if I do, I can be emancipated from this desire to eat and be happy about it. I can be happy about it. And that's the promise here. Let's go to step 3 on page 63. Middle of the page, we were now at step 3. Utter the prayer. I'm not going to read it here. You can read it for yourself. Do you have another prayer that you want to read? Go ahead. That's fine. What is the prayer for step 3 saying? I say it every single day of my life. I say this prayer every day. But what the prayer is really saying is, God, relieve me of the bondage of self. Relieve me of my difficulties. What are the difficulties? My character defects, so I can better do thy will. You want to say it in your own language, in your own way? Say it. But what is step 3? You're not turning anything over to anybody in step 3. You're making a decision to do so, and that means you do that in steps 4 through 12. 4 through 12. Now, if you've uttered your prayer, you should be starting on step 4. Step 4 is very important. I'm going to go through some things. Now, the podcast will explain about the instincts, and the podcast will explain all that stuff, as does the chapter, but the podcast expand on that stuff. But I just want to explain that step 4 should take a very short period of time. There are people, they've been working on step 4 for 6 months. They've been working on, no, you haven't. You've let it sit in your kitchen, or you've let it sit in your office for 6 months. You haven't been working on step 4 for 6 months. There's not that much to do. I give them 3 hours to do step 4. 3 hours. That's it. They're done. Done. You know who you resent or what you resent. You know who or what you fear. And you know who you've harmed in a sexual way. There's nothing here you don't know. There's no figuring anything out. There's nothing to figure out. There's nothing to learn. You know the answer to every question. Step four is the most misunderstood step. And in our zeal for perfection, we try to make it into something that it's not. And we try to do it perfectly so we never have to do it again. Good luck on that. I do them all the time. I have to. I have resentments. I have fears. I have this. I have that. So I have to do them all the time. You're not going to be in a place where you never have to do them again. I'm not going to go into the specifics of how to do step 4 because time is going, but they need to do it so that when we start this chapter, the next day they do step 5 with me. And I don't want to hear any horse hockey about they can't do it in one day. That's horse hockey. You get it done, and we move forward. This has to be the number one thing in your life without exception. If it's not, we're in the wrong place. The columns and everything is all in my podcast, so I absolutely leave them to their own devices. If they have any step 4 questions, they can ask me. Step 5, very simple. Very, very simple. I listen. I may offer a criticism or not a criticism. I may offer encouragement because, you know, they're scared. I will say, yeah, me too, me too. Let them feel more a part of humanity. They're scared. They've written this stuff down that if they've done a good job is secret to them and they didn't plan on sharing it with anybody. Let them know that the information here is not so shocking to you, that you've heard this before. Encourage them. Say, yeah, I had that too. Yeah, you did a good job on that. Yeah, make sure they did it right. Make sure they filled out all the columns and that it's done. And then say, do you see the patterns? Point out patterns. The resentment against your cousin, the resentment against your boss, the resentment against, are all based on you're afraid of what people are thinking about you. The two most important or two most impactful things that you're going to see in step four is romance and finance. And third is, I'm worried about what people are thinking about me. And you know what people are thinking about you most of the time? Nothing. You know what people are thinking about me most of the time? Nothing. But in my mind, I am the person that the whole world revolves around. Everybody's out to get me. No, they're not. No, they're not. And I can't be out of the food with that boogeyman chasing me down the street of everybody's out to get me and everybody's thinking about me and everybody's talking about me. No, they're not. No, they're not. Step six and seven shouldn't take more than about a minute. If it takes more than a minute, you're doing them incorrectly. You've reviewed your step four based on the information that you're looking at the destruction of your life through your defects of character in the fourth column of resentment, fourth column of fear, and the fourth column of your sexual inventory. Do you want to be rid of these defects? Yes. Now you're ready for seven. Say the prayer. Are you going to be permanently rid of these defects? No, that's why you have 10, 11, and 12. By this time, I've introduced them to steps 10 and 11 because it says in step 10, we vigorously commence this way of life as we cleaned up the past. What steps do we use to clean up the past? 4 through 9. So we vigorously commence this way of living, step 10. So I have them doing 10 steps immediately at this point. Now we're going to go to step 8. Here are the steps that have writing involved in them. We have a lot of written assignments. We have a lot of stuff, you know, write this and write that and do this and do that. Here are the steps that have written assignments, 4, 8, and sometimes 9. That's it. 4, 8, and sometimes 9. It's not wrong to write out your 11th step, but there's no such instruction in the big book that you should write it out. None whatsoever. So we're going to go to step 8. That shouldn't take very long. When you're done, we're going to start you on 9. Now, I want to hear their step 8. And what I want to hear is, what did you do to harm this person? Because a lot of times people want to make amends to somebody that they have not harmed. And the reason they want to make amends to that person is they want to see if they can get this person to like them when their relationship has been frayed. They want to use the amends process to sort of coax the person back into a friendship. Commonly asked questions in step 8 by me to them, what did you do to harm this person? I want a specific answer. I don't get an answer. We don't make a 9-step amends to that person. When they make amends in 9, they will own what they did. I did this. They will express their contrition. They will, you know, say, I want to do better now. I'm sorry I did that. I want to do better now. I want to make sure that, you know, and how do I make this right? If it was money, they pay the person back. If it was something of other, they restitute in kind. Eyeball to eyeball, face to face. Eyeball to eyeball, face to face. None of this texting an amends, emailing an amends. No, 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 no. Eyeball to eyeball, face to face. Very important. You stole from a store. It's not there anymore. There's no store. You try to find the owner. You can't find him. Okay, give money to charity. Do something that restitutes the world for what you did. Very important. Step 9. What did you do to harm this person? What did you do? Steps 10, 11, and 12. Step 10 is on page 84. I heard this morning on Vision. I heard all the time there's many, many ways to do step 10. Not according to the big book, there's not. Not according to the big book, there's not. And on page 84 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it very specifically gives you how to do them. It says continue to watch. Well, at first it says you continue to do step 4s throughout your life. Very important. Then it says continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. Pray the 7-step prayer. Ask him to remove it. We discuss it with someone immediately. Notice it doesn't say we email it. We text it. No, it doesn't. We discuss it, which means there's going to be a little bit of a discussion. Not an hour, 2 minutes. The person's going to, help me find my part and make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone. I'm going to make amends. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Step 12 is in step 10. You've got 12 and 10 and 11 and 9. Remember in 9 it says we ask in morning meditation on page 83. You work the steps together. You don't need to work them just in order. You work them together at the end part here. We ask, we discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Love and tolerance of others is our code. Very simple process. Step 11, the reason the nighttime is before the daytime is they assume you've been doing step 10s all day. That's why the nighttime is first. Step 10 and 11 are two completely separate steps. They are not one and the same. I want to talk to you about step 12, and then we'll open it up for questions and answers. I also talk to my sponsor every day. I have my sponsees call me every day. I don't care how long they've been with me. We check in with each other. We do what we need to do because every day is the day when I need the objective input of another human being because a solitary self-appraisal proved insufficient. I want to talk to you about step 12. It's a definite three-part step. And the first part of it is having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Stop right there. If you've had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, even if you don't think you've had one, if you've worked through and you're not eating, you need to sponsor. Stop waiting for willingness. Willingness is the byproduct of action. It's not the other way around. If I had to wait for willingness, I'd be dead. Dead. Dead, I tell you, dead. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message, not my message, not your message. Not the message of the sheets for step 4 or the sheets for step 10 or the booklet on this or this or that. Those are all fine things. That's not this message. This message is the message of the big book. This message to alcoholics. Very, very important. We are all carrying a message. We are all carrying a message whether we want to be carrying one or we are not. And the message that we're carrying is either the message of the disease or it is the message of the recovery. When my daughter was 19 months old, I was living in Eugene, Oregon. She was 19 months old. It was a Sunday morning, and she was running around in her diaper, and my then wife came in with a boatload of groceries, and I'm in complete relapse at this time. Complete and utter relapse at this time. And my wife and I are chatting, and we're sitting very close to one another. She's putting stuff away. I can see it now. And my daughter opened up the refrigerator with her little hand, and she opened it up, and she turned to her mother and said, "Shit, Esther, there's nothing in here." Where did she learn that? She learned that from Daddy. because without knowing it, without understanding what I was doing, I was opening up the refrigerator 20,000 times and saying, shit, Esther, there's nothing in here. 7 years later, we're living in Scottsdale, Arizona, and my recovery is beautiful. And we're watching the initial episode of a show called My Name is Earl. And Earl won the lottery, and he's going back to make amends to people that he robbed. And my daughter comes in. I'm watching the show. So the bottom line is, she says to me, these guys are just doing eight. They're just doing 8 and 9, right, Dad? And I said, yes. That's how far she had come without a word from me. You have the ability to give something to someone else that they cannot get anywhere else in the world. The psychiatrist cannot give that to them. The psychologist, those are fine things. I'm in therapy. They're fine things. I support that. They're great. It's in the big book. Make use of them. You can speak and understand the language of the heart. You can light them up and give them the one thing they need, and that is hope. Because if you can recover, maybe they can too. You can light them up to the world. You're a person. To this person who is suffering and dying, you could be the world. And light them up and give them something you can't buy, you can't find, and you can't get anywhere else but from somebody who has had the spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Any idiot can count the seeds in an apple, but only God can count the apples in a seed. You can be there for that person. You can give them hope. And you never know how or where the message is going to go. I'm reminded of my dead friend Scott. Scott was an alcoholic, a drug addict, and a compulsive overeater. And he was in New York in a Broadway play. On Broadway, that's how good he was. And he meets a girl in the show, and they decide to move to Los Angeles when the show was over. And they did. And he was very active in AA, very active in AA. And he goes out to Los Angeles, and he's on Saturday night. He was answering the phone. He gets a phone call from East LA. If you know nothing about LA, it's the low rent district in LA, if such a thing is possible. It's the low rent district of LA. And they always go out in twos. So he and this other guy go out to this seedy motel in East Los Angeles, California. And they find a man sitting on his bed with a bottle of whiskey drunk. And they're talking to this guy for about an hour, and they realize he's falling asleep. So they put him in bed, they take off his shoes, they cover him up, and they leave. 5 years later. 5 years later, Scott is speaking in San Diego, and he's done, and a man walks up to him and clamps a bear hug on him and says to him, "You saved my life." And Scott says, "I don't believe I know you." And the guy says, "Oh, yeah, you're Scott, right?" He says, "Yes." The guy says to Scott, "Remember a few years ago you came to a motel in East LA and you talked to a guy at the motel?" He said, "Yeah, but you weren't there." He says, "That guy died a few months after you were there. He died." He says, "Well, how did I save your life?" He says, "When you were in that motel, I was hiding under the bed. I heard every word you said, and I haven't had a drink in 5 years because of what you said that night." Any idiot can count the seeds in an apple, but only God Almighty can count the apples in a seed. You do not know the power of the message until you unleash it. This book contains things and ideals that were not thought of originally by Bill Wilson. Maybe they were thought of by some drunk who came to three meetings, never came back again, but something that guy said is in this book, and we accept it as the gospel, and it helps me live instead of die. Go out there and do God's work. There's an unbroken chain between Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob, and a spark was struck on June the 10th, 1935, really June 17th, but that's okay. And it came to a man, it was passed failing hand to failing shaking hand from DTs. That message got passed from one person to the next, to the next, to the next. And one day it got passed to a man by the name of Jim Willis. And Jim Willis was the founder of a program in Los Angeles, in Oxnard, California, really, Oxnard, called Gamblers Anonymous. And this Gamblers Anonymous, five members of this organization appeared on a Paul Coates show that was shown in Los Angeles. The Paul Coates show. He hasn't been on the air in 60 years. And there was a woman watching the show named Roseanne Scholar. And it was November of 1959. And she realized that one of her husband's friends had a gambling problem. And she made a decision that Marvin and her, Marvin was her husband, were going to take this man to a meeting of Gamblers Anonymous. And they did in late November of 1959. And Roseanne sat in the back of the meeting, and she related to everything she heard. She related to everything she heard. And she realized that this could be what she had been waiting for her entire life, because she was struggling with food. And Jim Willis, the founder of GA, just happened to be at the meeting. And she comes up to Jim Willis and says, "My name is Roseanne. Do you think a program like yours with steps could help someone like me with food?" And he heard the pain in her voice and said, "You know, Roseanne, I don't see why not." And on January the 19th, 1960, the very first meeting of Overeaters Anonymous took place in West Los Angeles, California. In Luling, Texas at this time, there was a man named A.G. Ainsworth, and he was coming home from a church retreat, and he was with his friend Robert, who was in AA. And A.G. had been suffering from obesity his whole life, and he said to Robert in such a way so that he could make Robert think he was kidding in case Robert turned on him and made fun of him. "Robert, do you think a program like yours with Alcoholics Anonymous, you think it would help someone like me with food?" And Robert heard the pain in his voice and said, "You know, A.G., I don't see why not." And there was another woman in Luling, Texas named Norma B. And Norma B. and A.G. Ainsworth founded an organization called Gluttons Anonymous. And if you look in any given good dictionary, glutton fits me specifically, fits me entirely. And there were five groups of Gluttons Anonymous in and around Luling, Texas, and 16 groups of Overeaters Anonymous in the Los Angeles area. One day, A.G. Ainsworth called the AA office in New York and asked the AA office in New York if there was anybody that they knew about that was using steps and the book for their eating problem, and they put him in touch with Roseanne. And on a Sunday afternoon, representatives of all five groups of GA, along with Norma B. and A.G., called Roseanne, and it was like Stanley finding Livingston. A.G. flew out in his private plane, and in 1962, he became the first man in OA, not because he accomplished anything so special, but he was, the charter of OA did not allow men in. It was for women only. He not only became the first man in OA, but he became the first chairman of the board of trustees at a first business conference. And in a vote of 16-5, we became Overeaters Anonymous. And we have flourished thus far. Is it odd or is it God that here we sit today in 2024? I've given you a smidgen of information on how to sponsor. But before we close, I want to remind you that we do not tailor specific programs for each person that we sponsor. You have to be the adult in the room. You have to stand firm. You cannot be wishy-washy or wimpy. You've got to be the adult in the room. And if they don't want to do what you're telling them to do, read the top of page 96 and probably let them go. You have to be the adult. Nobody is the perfect sponsor. Not I, not anybody. Nothing is perfect. Nobody is perfect. You don't have to be perfect to be a sponsor. All you have to do is the best you can and let the book do the heavy lifting. Let the big book of AA do the heavy lifting. The doctor's opinion through chapter 3 is step 1. Chapter 4, step 2. Chapter 5, steps 3 and 4. Chapter 6, steps 5 through 11. And chapter 7, step 12. Let the book do the heavy lifting. Let's go to page 100. We're going to finish with the 12-step promises, and then we'll page 100, the 12-step promises. Both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. I want to thank the committee, Diane, and all the translators and all the people whose hard work made this possible. I want to thank you for your work and your diligence. I didn't even want to do this, but she just beat me down. So I said, okay, I'll do it. Okay. So I want to thank you guys for putting this together. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as we charge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. I hope that we've given you some good information. I hope that we have helped you become a better sponsor. If in a perfect world there was an unlimited amount of time, I would have gone into copious details in every word of these steps.
Thank you. Thank you, Harlan.
The opinions expressed here today are strictly those of the individual OA member and do not represent OA as a whole.